Good day, everyone. This is Ed at the Talking Information Center of the Massachusetts Radio Network, bringing you articles from the National Interest Magazine, the spring version. And we're going to lead off this week with James Parks' essay, Why North Korean Denuclearization is No Longer Possible. James Park is a research associate at the Quincy Institute's East Asia Program. At North Korea's Ninth Party Congress in late February, Kim Jong-un delivered a speech reiterating that his country's nuclear status, which was enshrined in the North Korean Constitution in 2023, is completely and absolutely irreversible, and denuclearization can never happen. Adding to that, Kim signaled openness to conditional engagement with the United States, suggesting that, if the U.S. respects the present position of our state specified in the Constitution and withdraws its hostile policy towards the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, there is no reason why we cannot get on well with the U.S., end quote from Kim Jong-un. Kim's speech is another reaffirmation of Pyongyang's consistent signal to Washington throughout the past year. It is willing to reengage, provided that certain preconditions are met. Among them, the most emphatically stressed North Korean demand is that the United States stop pursuing denuclearization. Pyongyang has made this point abundantly clear in multiple public statements, including another speech by Kim Jong-un in September of 25, in which he acknowledged his good memories with President Trump, but asserted that there will be no talks without the United States freeing itself from its absurd pursuit of denuclearization. In reaction to Kim's speech, the White House responded by saying that U.S. policy on North Korea has not changed. President Trump remains open to talking with Kim Jong-un without any preconditions. From North Korea's perspective, the White House statement attaches unacceptable preconditions. It does not specifically mention denuclearization, but the line, U.S. policy on North Korea has not changed, suggests that denuclearization remains the U.S. goal. If the Trump has any desire to resume diplomacy with North Korea, simply repeating that it is open to talks without preconditions is at best insufficient. Washington would have to make a bold decision to take denuclearization off the table. North Korea has few reasons to trust the U.S. The harsh reality Washington has to grapple with is that the possibility of pursuing North Korean denuclearization, whether through diplomatic persuasion or coercive pressure, looks non-existent. Kim Jong-un may have had a plausible reasons to a degree on it in denuclearization talks back in 2018 and 2019. Despite notable improvements, his nuclear deterrence buildup remained far from completion. Geopolitical conditions were also unfavorable, with China and Russia maintaining a good distance from North Korea. North Korea's long-term strategic outlook did not look at all promising at that time. Now, Pyongyang is in a far better strategic position. North Korea is far more resilient in the face of international sanctions, thanks to its newly reinvigorated alliance with Russia and improved ties with China. Since the last Trump-Kim summit in 2019, North Korea has also advanced its nuclear capability significantly. It is now able to threaten a second strike against U.S. targets in its neighborhood, American bases in South Korea and Japan, and possibly even the American mainland. Taking all these trends into account, the Kim regime looks more secure than ever, as one longtime North Korea expert, Andrei Lankov, observed recently. What's more, if Kim had any remaining faith in Trump's commitment to peace from their intimate engagements in 2018 and 2019, Trump's reckless military campaigns against Venezuela and Iran this year should compel Kim to reassess Trump's intent. Watching Trump oust the Nicolas Maduro regime in Venezuela by force and launch a preventive war against Iran in the middle of denuclearization negotiations, Kim must be only more convinced that he was absolutely right to reject Trump's demand to immediately hand over all nuclear weapons. Trump's use of force against Venezuela does not necessarily introduce a new source of anxiety for Kim. North Korea has never been naive about the long-term U.S. track record of regime change efforts and what that applies for its own future. It will, however, inevitably reinforce Kim's existing conviction that North Korea's future without nuclear weapons is unthinkable. Why U.S.-North Korea policy should move beyond denuclearization? Ultimately, if the Trump administration has any intention of bringing North Korea back to the negotiating table, it has to move past denuclearization and start thinking seriously about the next steps. Of course, this can be more difficult than it sounds. For Washington, one big source of uncertainty is, after denuclearization is taken off the table, what does North Korea really want to discuss and achieve in negotiations? Pyongyang's demand that Washington stop pursuing denuclearization sounds straightforward, but the devil is in the details. Would Pyongyang settle for tacit recognition as a nuclear state, as long as it gets to keep its nuclear deterrent? Or does it see eventual formal recognition as essential? The distinction between the two matters. Tacit recognition would involve the U.S. dropping denuclearization from its declaratory policy, but also continuing to avoid publicly recognizing North Korea's nuclear status. In this scenario, while the focus of U.S. policy would shift to arms control and stability, the scenario of resuming progress towards denuclearization in the distant future would not be entirely foreclosed. It can be argued that tacit recognition, though entailing risks, is something Washington could manage. On the other hand, formal recognition would involve the U.S. and the international community explicitly recognizing North Korea as a legitimate nuclear power. This would require amending the Non-Proliferation Treaty to include North Korea, which would not only create a formal legal barrier to denuclearization, but also wreak havoc on the NPT's credibility. This scenario would be unacceptable for Washington in many ways. There has been growing speculation that North Korea views an explicit U.S. recognition of its nuclear status as a prerequisite for engagement. Such speculation is reasonable, considering that Pyongyang has an obvious incentive to consolidate its nuclear status and make it as irreversible as possible. In that effort, Pyongyang amended its constitution in 2023 to enshrine its nuclear status in law and now routinely underscores the constitutional illegality of denuclearization. For instance, in her July 25 statement, Kim Yo-yong, Kim Jong-un's sister and North Korea's top foreign policy advisor, stressed that any attempt to deny the position of the DPRK as a nuclear weapon state fixed by the supreme law will be thoroughly rejected, end quote. Kim Jong-un's September speech also emphasized that asking us to accept denuclearization now is as good as asking us to go against our constitution. Likewise, his recent speech at the Ninth Party Congress urged the U.S. to respect the position of our state specified in the constitution of the DPRK. Nevertheless, such North Korean rhetoric remains ambiguous. The condition of not denying North Korea's nuclear status and respecting the regime's position specified in the Constitution may not require formal recognition. The state of tacit recognition, taking denuclearization off the table and treating North Korea as an arms control counterpart without formal acceptance of its nuclear status, could possibly meet this bar. One may argue that even if tacit recognition technically meets Pyongyang's bar, Pyongyang has no reason to forego maximalist goals in favor of compromised arms control diplomacy. That may be true, but also false. Pyongyang has an interest in avoiding an inadvertent conflict on the Korean Peninsula that escalates into a potentially existential war, so it may see incentives in building guardrails that do not require giving up deterrence, i.e. denuclearization. Furthermore, improving its relationship with the United States, even at the expense of some concessions, may have long-term geopolitical appeal for North Korea. Pyongyang seems positioned to maintain stable ties with Moscow and Beijing for the foreseeable future. However, North Korea's relationships with both Russia and China have historically been shaky, with many ups and downs, and can always go downhill again. Despite North Korea's wishful rhetoric of a new Cold War, authoritarian coalition, that the reality looks far from that. China prioritizes pragmatic partnerships and is not keen on forming an authoritarian axis. The North Korea-Russian strategic alliance will likely persist, but the depth of ties and cooperation may very well loosen after the war in Ukraine. A cohesive authoritarian coalition that North Korea could count for in long-term stability seems unlikely to materialize, which could lead Pyongyang to consider negotiations with Washington. Besides the dilemma of North Korea's nuclear status, there are other tough questions that Washington would have to ponder, such as what changes could arms control diplomacy with North Korea bring to the U.S. force posture in South Korea. An easy assumption to make is that Pyongyang would seek to make U.S. forces completely out of the Korean Peninsula. It would certainly have a broad interest in U.S. withdrawal from Korea, but to what extent could be up for debate. Pyongyang may understand that insisting on a sweeping withdrawal would make U.S. accommodations far less likely and drive Washington away from negotiations. So it may not rule out the possibility of coexistence with some U.S. military presence in Korea. Relatedly, Washington and Seoul should consider whether it is essential to maintain the current level of nearly 30,000 U.S. troops in South Korea, a level unchanged for several decades, despite the growth of a far stronger South Korean military. North Korea's military has lagged behind the South, and the South now far outmatches it in conventional military terms, so maintaining deterrence on the Korean Peninsula could be feasible even in the scenario of a considerable U.S. military drawdown. The key component of U.S. extended deterrence for South Korea, the U.S. nuclear umbrella, U.S. intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities, and U.S. presence to serve as a tripwire, could remain effective without a large number of boots on the ground. A reduction in U.S. forces might be appealing to the Trump administration in itself, but it would be better to secure concessions from the North in exchange. The Korean nuclear status quo is unsustainable. Status quo. The bottom line is that while the U.S. would not be naive about North Korea's motives and goals, it should not assume the worst and prematurely reject the idea of moving past denuclearization to pursue new diplomacy. In the end, Washington will not find out what Pyongyang wants and is willing to compromise until they sit down at the negotiating table. Indeed, there are many difficult and uncomfortable questions when thinking about what comes next after moving past denuclearization, which may encourage Washington to opt for the status quo. But the status quo of trying to deter an increasingly nuclear-capable North Korea while pursuing denuclearization, which Pyongyang finds excessively hostile and is determined to confront at all costs, is becoming more and more dangerous and unsustainable. Now that the Trump administration is fighting an indefinite war in the Middle East, all the while conducting trade negotiations with China, peace talks with Russia, and more assertive operations in Venezuela, it's hard to imagine it can pivot attention to North Korea anytime soon. But sooner or later, Washington will have to explore an alternative approach to North Korea beyond denuclearization. Eleanor Hardegree is our next author. Eleanor Hardegree joined the research team at the Stimson Center Strategic Foresight Hub in January of 26. She writes, "How the U.S. is squandering its science and technology advantage." Since the second Trump administration began in early 25, funding cuts to scientific research have disrupted the work of many U.S. universities and government agencies. These cuts have worrying implications for critical research, the economy, and the future of U.S. scientific talent. Reducing resources at a time when China is forging ahead, if not already ahead, in certain emerging technologies risks U.S. science and technology leadership. Against this backdrop of increased competition with U.S., the United States is bizarrely abandoning its advantage in basic research, higher education, and the ability to attract international talent in stark opposition to the American approach to the USSR during the Cold War. 1 year after President Donald Trump's inauguration, his administration has terminated or frozen over 7,800 research grants. This affected 1,300 grants at the National Science Foundation, resulting in around $700 million in unspent funds at the end of the fiscal year 25. Additionally, the National Institute of Health saw about $2.3 billion in unspent funds across nearly 2,500 frozen or terminated grants. But the cutbacks didn't end there. They have impacted U.S. agencies across the board. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, has also taken significant hits from the Trump administration, with its spending plan $246 million short of the funds appropriated by Congress. Despite receiving the same appropriations as in 2024, NOAA spent $53 million less on climate research in 25, a 25% reduction from $219 million to $165 million. These are only a few examples of the affected science agencies. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, and others also experienced their funding frozen or terminated. Overall, the Trump administration targeted projects on topics perceived as opposed to its social and political agendas, including vaccines, countering misinformation, environmental protection, and diversity, equity, and inclusion. Grants are reportedly being frozen for using politically sensitive terms like gender or climate. There is no clear successor to fill the gap left by federal funding. The private sector cannot feasibly fill this gap, as the Vice President of the National Association of College and University Business Officers, Ruth Johnson, described such an idea as idealistic but not realistic. The extent of funding that the private sector would need to fill the gaps left by federal grants is insurmountable. Additionally, the private sector has an incentive to invest in research and development activities that generate near-term profit benefits rather than in basic research funded by the U.S. government, which cannot be commercialized immediately but leads to future innovation. Such basic research can be immensely valuable. For example, Google was born from a $4.5 million National Science Foundation grant to two Stanford graduate students who developed an internet search engine. Looking forward to 2026, the administration's agenda involves yet more aggressive cuts in scientific R&D funding. Originally, the administration's proposed budget for fiscal 26 would have cut non-defense R&D spending by $42 billion, or 21%. In this proposed plan, the NSF would have been cut by 57%, the NIH by 41%, and the EPA by 34%, and NASA by 24%, representing historic lows in funding. In the end, however, the federal budget that Congress passed included just a 5% cut to non-defense R&D, according to the analysis by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS. We love our acronyms in government work. Nevertheless, reports detail that the scientific community is not celebrating. Alessandra Zimmerman, who analyzes R&D spending for AAAS, shares that even small budget cuts would have been shocking to the NSF a few years ago. Furthermore, the inclusion of funding in the budget does not mean it will be dispersed. The administration may continue last year's precedent of withholding funds authorized by Congress. Many also anticipate that Trump will again propose big cuts to science in the 27 federal budget. Another crucial piece of this anti-science agenda is the Trump administration's targeting of higher education institutions, particularly elite research universities. The Center for American Progress reported in July of 25 that over 600 colleges and universities have been affected by the Trump administration's federal funding cuts. Many of the main cuts targets were Ivy League universities or other top U.S. research institutions that Trump sees as centers of wokeism. For example, in March, $400 million in federal spending was cut from Columbia University. In April, Harvard University had $2.2 billion in grants frozen, and Cornell saw $1 billion and lost federal funding. University of Pennsylvania, $175 million, Princeton, $210 million, and Northwest University's $790 million also saw hundreds of millions of dollars cut, frozen, or suspended. These funding cuts are an unprecedented tactic in the administration's efforts to control universities' internal policies, which critics charge as a serious infringement on academic freedom. Six universities brokered deals with the administration, agreeing to certain conditions, such as sharing admissions data, complying with the Department of Justice's DEI guidance, and in most cases, paying large settlements to restore federal funding. In another approach, Harvard succeeded in suing the Trump administration over its attempts to exert control over the institution, with a federal judge ruling that the administration's termination of the grants broke the law in a targeted, ideologically motivated assault. While university funding has now largely been unfrozen, the university's research progress was considerably disrupted in the past year, and the effects are still lingering, according to Gary Miller, vice dean for research at Columbia. Moreover, these deals have not stopped the U.S. government from attempting to reduce future funding. In November of 25, a State Department proposal surfaced in the media that would suspend 38 universities, including Harvard and Yale, from a critical research partnership program due to their DEI hiring practices. Beyond funding cuts, U.S. universities have also suffered from the Trump administration's restrictions on international students. According to a January social media post from the State Department, the Trump administration has revoked roughly 8,000 student visas. The administration launched a wide variety of efforts to discourage international students' attendance, including canceling the legal status of hundreds of international students in a federal database, attempting to aggressively revoke visas of Chinese nationals, and specifically targeting Harvard's 6,800 foreign students. As a result, the number of international students entering the U.S. fell 19% on year, the Department of Homeland Security reported in August of 25. The economic and telling consequences of anti-R&D policies on the U.S. In addition to the loss of critical research, there are long-term economic repercussions to cutting R&D funding. Congressional Budget Office estimates that every additional dollar invested in non-defense R&D increases gross domestic product by an average of $11.50 in present term value terms over 30 years. The report clarifies that cutting R&D results in comparable negative effects on the economy. Declines in international students studying in the U.S. could also cut tens of billions of dollars from the American economy. For the 23 to 24 year, reports that international students contributed $43 billion to the American economy. Specifically, the reduction in international talent represents a loss of important future innovation for the scientific and technology innovation for the U.S. In fact, a study from the National Foundation for American Policy found that 55% of U.S. startups valued at over $1 billion had at least one immigrant founder. The country has already suffered a steep loss in current scientific expertise in the federal governments over the past year. Office of Personnel Management data revealed that in 2025, 10,109 doctoral-trained experts in science and work-related fields left the federal workforce. This added up to 106,636 years of federal work experience lost across STEM and health roles. Science analyzed, I guess that's Science Magazine, analyzed 14 agencies and found that every one of them lost far more STEM PhDs in 25 than in 24, an average of three times as many. All these departures represent a large rupture in the scientific pipeline in the U.S. Let's look at contrasting strategies from foreign competitors. While the U.S. cuts R&D, foreign competitors are pursuing a directly opposite strategy to capitalize on U.S. losses. If we look at China, the comparison is stark, as the leadership there has increased funding for R&D and sought to attract foreign talent. In 24, according to the Chinese National Bureau of Statistics, R&D spending was up 8.3% year-on-year and exceeded 3 trillion yuan, which is $489.9 billion. In November of 25, Alessandra Zimmerman suggested that China may have already overtaken the U.S. in R&D spending, sending the global system into uncharted territory. In addition to increased funding, China has created programs to attract foreign researchers, including a visa program launched in the fall of 25 for overseas graduates in science and technology. The government hosted China Scholarship Council and country partnerships through the Belt and Road Initiative have also significantly boosted international student attendance by providing fully funded scholarships. China is not the only country on this trajectory of investing heavily in R&D and scientific talent amid upheaval in the U.S. Other international actors have created programs aimed at attracting researchers leaving the U.S. For example, the European Union set up a super grant program in June of 25, injecting $566 million into the European Research Council for 25 to 27 to attract researchers. Spain, Australia, and Japan, among others, have also joined the global competition to attract talent through new programs. All these initiatives demonstrate that the R&D agenda is risking the United States' global competitiveness. So what are the indicators of Chinese scientific dominance? These events are playing out at a time when indicators suggest that China is already forging ahead in certain areas of scientific leadership. One sign of China's growing competencies is its activity in patents. In 24, innovators in China filed around 1.8 million patent applications, while the U.S. filed only 501,831, according to the World Intellectual Property Organization. China's 9% growth in filings marked its fifth consecutive year of growth and the fastest since 2018. On the other hand, the U.S. reported a much slower increase than the other top five patent filing countries, with 0.8% growth rate. In this way, China's higher volume reflects a national prioritization of securing science and technology intellectual property. Another illustrative example is China's dominance in renewable energy, an area where the U.S. has failed to compete and is unlikely to catch up. By 2023, China had installed a total renewable energy capacity of 1,322 gigawatts, more than double the U.S., 468 gigawatts. The International Energy Agency projects that China will account for nearly 60% of global renewable energy additions by 2030. Chinese universities have also begun to overtake U.S. universities in top ratings across various ranking platforms. In July of 25, the World University Rankings, published by the Center for World University Rankings, okay, showed that China overtook the U.S. for the first time in the Global 2000 list, an evaluation of the top 2,000 universities worldwide based on indicators across quality of education, employability of graduates, faculty accolades, and research output. By these metrics, China's prominence rose from the previous year, accounting for 346 of the top spots, while the U.S. presence dropped to 319 institutions. Additionally, the 2025 Leiden ranking by the Center for Science and Technology Studies, based solely on bibliometric data, placed China's Zhejiang University first and Harvard third. All the remaining spots in the top 10 were Chinese universities, apart from Canada's University of Toronto. This offers a sharp contrast to 10 years earlier in the 2015 Leiden ranking, when 9 U.S. institutions occupied the top 10, and China's most highly respected university was in the 119th place. After the Soviet Union launched its Sputnik satellite in 1957, President Eisenhower mobilized a major campaign to upgrade U.S. scientific R&D and education in order to compete with Moscow. Within 6 months, U.S. space R&D budget expanded from an average of $500 million a year to more than $10.5 billion, the equivalent of about $118 billion today. Today, despite the Trump administration's rhetoric about competition with China, the U.S. is doing China a favor by undermining its own domestic R&D capacity. President Xi seems to have a better appreciation for the importance of science and technology research for his country's standing, as shown in his 2022 opening speech at the 20th National Congress of the Communist Party of China, where he urged China to regard science and technology as our primary productive force, talent as our primary resource, and innovation as our primary driver of growth. Though the exact opportunity cost of this policy divergence, the exact opportunity costs of this policy divergence are difficult to calculate, policymakers and scientists alike ought to worry that several years of R&D cuts and systemic exclusion of foreign talent will leave the U.S. unable to reestablish its global scientific and economic leadership. Next up from the National Interest magazine, fast power versus slow power, the new energy contest. The co-authors are Tatiana Mitrova, Kruthika Anastasia Bala. Tatiana Mitrova is a global research fellow at Columbia University Center on Global Energy Policy and director of New Energy Advancement Hub. Kruthika Anastasia Bala is the managing director of Resources Now. For much of the past decade, energy policy debates were framed around energy transition pathways, climate ambition, and technological change. That framing increasingly fails to capture the strategic reality. The central dynamic today is strategic rivalry between two deeply independent systems, one rooted primarily in hydrocarbons and financial architecture, and the other is organized in electrification, manufacturing scale, and supply chains. Decarbonization unfolds within this competitive structure rather than along a smooth, linear path. Moving past the idea of treating fossil fuels and electrification as competing states, contemporary energy politics can be understood as an interaction between parallel systems of influence operating through markets, infrastructure, and rules. That interaction has shifted into a more confrontational phrase. Competitive positioning now carries an adversarial edge. Each side advances its own model while actively working to constrain the other's room for maneuver. Energy in this environment becomes a terrain of cross-system interference. This dynamic can be understood as a rivalry under deep interdependence, where advantage is pursued by shaping how the other system functions rather than by replacing it. Energy statecraft, therefore, has entered a phase of interdependent rivalry in which major powers seek not only to manage their own energy systems, but to influence, constrain, and selectively disrupt the functioning of rival systems within conditions of deep economic interdependence. The U.S. and China remain structurally interdependent. Hydrocarbon flows, financial systems, mineral supply chains, industrial productions, and infrastructure investments still connect their economies to each other and in the wider world. The governing mentality, however, has changed. Policy is increasingly shaped by zero-sum logic, focused not only on strengthening one's own system, but also preventing the other from consolidating advantage. The recent escalation in the Middle East illustrates how rapidly this rivalry can move from regulatory and financial pressure to overt coercive signaling. The U.S. strikes on Iranian targets demonstrate how petro-hegemon can combine military force, sanctions architecture, and market signaling in a single move. Such actions are not isolated security events. They reshape risk perceptions, insurance costs, shipping calculations, and capital allocations across interconnected energy systems. Military instruments in this sense amplify rather than replace financial market leverage. When interdependent systems adopt a zero-sum framework, several predictable dynamics follow. First, escalation loops intensify. A sanction, tariff, or export restriction or regulatory barrier triggers countermeasures. Each defensive adjustment produces new vulnerabilities, which then become targets. Transparency declines, workarounds multiply, and the system becomes less predictable. Second, systems harden rather than decouple. Complete separation is prohibitively costly. Instead, states start to build redundancy, parallel supply chains, alternative payment channels, strategic stockpiles, localized production. The result is not fragmentation into isolated blocks, but a more rigid form of interdependence, which is more expensive, less flexible, and more politically charged. Third, competition shifts from efficiency optimization to vulnerability exploitation. The objective becomes identifying pressure points that yield disproportionate leverage. In energy systems, these include maritime choke points, insurance markets, clearing systems, mineral processing nodes, grid bottlenecks, and financing structures. As rivalry intensifies, energy systems become harder to read. Price signals blur, regulatory intent becomes ambiguous, and strategic actors increasingly treat opacity itself as an instrument of leverage. It is in this environment that energy statecraft mutates. Defining the two logics of energy statecraft. Before rivalry intensified, energy statecraft operated through two distinct but relatively stable logistics. The distinction between petrostates and electrostates has provided a useful lens for understanding how energy systems shape national positioning and strategic choices, as discussed in earlier analyses published in The National Interest, including petrostates and electrostates in a world divided by fossil fuels and clean energy, and the EU in a petrostates and electrostates world. These articles examined how resource endowments and electrification capabilities structure geopolitical options. The present analysis moves one layer deeper, from categorizing states to examining how rival systems interfere with one another under conditions of strategic competition. Petro-hegemony rests on the capacity to integrate hydrocarbons with financial security and institutional power through state market coalitions rather than direct command. It describes a structural position within the global energy systems. A petro-hegemon is not simply a large producer or exporter, but a state capable of setting the operating boundaries of hydrocarbon markets, shaping price responsiveness, controlling financial clearing access, restricting participation through sanctions, and securing maritime energy flows. The clearest contemporary example is the U.S. American shale production provides rapid supply responsiveness. Dollar-dominated trade embeds U.S. financial oversight into global oil and gas markets. Sanctions enforcement, regulatory tools, and maritime security reinforces the capacity to influence who trades, under what conditions, and with what financing. Electro-hegemony develops through manufacturing volume, supply chain centrality, critical minerals processing, and large-scale infrastructure building, which gradually shapes cost structure and creates path dependence across energy systems. An electro-hegemon is not merely a clean technology leader. It is a state capable of setting the cost trajectory of electrification through manufacturing scale, supply chain centrality, infrastructure embedding, and long-term path dependency. Its clearest practitioner is China, operating through state-owned and private conglomerates across batteries, solar manufacturing, electricity grids, and critical minerals processing. Influence emerges not from the immediate coercion, but from cumulative integration. In normal competitive conditions, these two logics coexist. Hydrocarbon leverage manages shocks. Electrification leverage shapes cost trajectories. How rivalry mutates each logic. Under zero-sum rivalry, both logistics shape from system management to system manipulation. Instruments once used to stabilize markets or coordinate cost trajectories become tools for shaping the risk environment of rivals. The mutation of petro-statecraft. In its stabilizing form, petro-statecraft seeks to contain volatility and maintain market functioning. The coordinated release of strategic reserves, diplomatic engagement with producers, and liquidity provisions are instruments of system management. Under rivalry, the same tools acquire a more strategic character. Sanctions enforcement determines who can sell hydrocarbons and under what conditions, while trade measures, regulatory barriers, export controls, and access to financial infrastructure operates as deliberate instruments of leverage rather than passive background policies. What was once primarily a means of disciplining rogue actors becomes a mechanism for shaping the broader competitive environment. Petrostatecraft increasingly performs three functions. First, boundary setting. By controlling access to clearing systems, insurance markets, and financial channels, the petrohegemon defines who may participate in energy trade. This is not only about restricting adversaries' revenue, it's about increasing uncertainty and capital costs within rival systems. Second, strategic disruption. Volatility itself can become instrumental. Even moderate price swings, if timed against industrial investment cycles, can alter the risk calculations of firms embedded in competing supply chains. Third, regulatory shaping. Trade measures and export controls influence the cost structure of downstream manufacturing, include clean technology sectors. Energy tools thus spill into industrial competition. A fourth dimension has become increasingly visible, kinetic signaling. Limited military action against energy-linked targets can reinforce sanctions credibility, reshape market expectations, and demonstrate enforcement capacity. When combined with financial and regulatory tools, coercive action extends petrostatecraft beyond markets into the security domain. The objective is not territorial control, but systemic signaling. Petrostatecraft shifts from crisis stabilization to shaping the risk environment of rivals. The mutation of electrostatecraft. Electrostatecraft traditionally operates through commercial expansion, scaling production, lowering costs, embedding infrastructure abroad, and integrating supply chains. Under rivalry, this logic also hardens. Chinese firms frequently deliver integrated packages of equipment, construction, and technical support that embed their technologies within national energy systems and raise the cost of switching suppliers. What was once interpreted primarily as a commercial bundling becomes, in strategic terms, dependency engineering. Electrostatecraft under pressure evolves along three lines. First, defensive consolidation. Export controls on sensitive materials, tighter oversight of outbound investment, and supply chain tightening reflect an effort to shield critical nodes from external interference. Second, parallel system construction. Alternative financing arrangements, payment mechanisms, and trade channels reduce exposure to the petrohegemon's financial tools. Shadow fleets, non-dollar settlements, and south-south infrastructure networks create partial insulation. And third, trajectory locking. By maintaining manufacturing scale and driving down costs, the electrohegemon shapes long-term technological direction. Even if rivals impose tariffs or restrictions, the underlying cost advantage can persist. Electrostatecraft shifts from commercial integration to geopolitical insulation. Fast power and slow power. Under rivalry, interference unfolds across different temporal dimensions. Fast and slow power do not simply refer to speed in a generic sense. They describe distinct forms of leverage operating within different economic cycles. Fast power operates within short market and regulatory cycles. It alters participation conditions, liquidity, access, price formation, and risk perception in real time. Slow power operates across longer industrial and capital cycles. It reshapes cost structures, supply chain architecture, and technological trajectories over years or decades. Petrostatecraft produces fast power. It represents a form of institutional and coercive market power. Its leverage stems from control over financial clearing systems, sanctions enforcement, regulatory exclusions, insurance access, maritime choke points, and liquidity provision. These instruments allow the petrohegemon to define who participates in markets, under what conditions, and at what cost. This power works through participation, denial, capital cost manipulation, and immediate disruption. Access can be expanded or restricted almost instantly. Sanctions can interrupt flows within weeks. Financial restrictions can alter credit conditions overnight. Market expectations adjust rapidly when enforcement credibility is reinforced, whether through regulatory tightening, sanctions escalation, or military signaling that demonstrates the willingness to act. Electrostatecraft produces slower building structural power. It represents structural and industrial leverage rather than institutional control. Its foundations lie in manufacturing scale, critical minerals processing, supply chain centrality, infrastructure embedding, and control over cross trajectories. Rather than denying participation directly, electropower shapes the conditions under which participation becomes economically viable. It creates path dependency. By lowering unit costs, embedding infrastructure, and concentrating production capacity, it influences which technologies dominate, where capital accumulates, and how difficult switching becomes once systems are built. In conceptual terms, petropower governs markets, electropower governs system architecture. The former sets the rules of access, the latter shapes the physical industrial foundation upon which access depends. The distinction also reflects capital cycle asymmetry. Petro interference operates largely within existing infrastructure and financial frameworks. It leverages tools already embedded in the global market governance. Electro interference reshapes capital stock itself. Factories, processing facilities, transmission networks, embedded supply chains require long-term investment and create inertia. Once established, reversal is slow and costly. Fast power disrupts, slow power endures. Petro power dominates moments of shock. It compresses time rapidly, repricing geopolitical risk and altering market access. Electro power shapes trajectories over longer horizons. It locks in technological direction and industrial advantage across decades. Under zero-sum rivalry, each side attempts to offset its temporal disadvantage. The petro hegemon seeks to limit cumulative industrial expansion that could erode its institutional leverage. The electro hegemon seeks to reduce exposure to fast-acting financial and regulatory pressures by constructing deeper industrial insulation. The strategic contest, therefore, is not merely about volume or technology. It is about which system can absorb disruption without abandoning its long-term trajectory. The more intense the rivalry, the more both systems must operate simultaneously in the realm of shock management and structural endurance. The contrast can be summarized as follows: fast and slow power in energy statecraft. Structural consequences for energy systems. When interference becomes routine, energy systems structurally change. First, costs rise. Redundant infrastructure, diversification away from the lowest cost suppliers, localized production mandates, and risk premium increases capital intensity. Systems built for global efficiency are retrofitted for resilience. Second, innovation is distorted. Investment flows are guided less by pure economic return and more by strategic positioning. Technologies that reduce vulnerability may receive priority over those that maximize efficiency. Third, politicization becomes permanent. Energy markets lose their status as relatively neutral coordination mechanisms. Every major infrastructure decision, pipelines, liquefied natural gas, terminals, battery plants, mineral refineries, acquire geopolitical weight. Fourth, vulnerability mapping becomes central. States and firms analyze exposure not only to price volatility, but also to regulatory, financial, and logistical choke points. The architecture of interdependence becomes a map of potential pressure. Yet, rivalry can also generate adaptive effects. Competitive pressure accelerates domestic capacity building, diversifies the supply chain, and reduces complacency within critical infrastructure sectors. Strategic competition may catalyze innovation in storage, grid resilience, alternative payment systems, and redundancy design. While costly, such hardening could produce more shock-absorbent systems over time. Importantly, interdependence does not disappear. It hardens. The systems remain connected, but through thicker, more guarded interfaces. Beyond the two hegemons. Most other states do not design the logic of interference. They absorb it. Their energy systems must navigate higher volatility, fragmented supply chains, and increased political risk. Some attempt hedging strategies, diversifying suppliers, cultivating multiple financial relationships, and building domestic capacity where feasible. But their main room for maneuver is constrained by the structural contest between the dominant logics. Energy security for them becomes less about diversification for its own sake and more about managing exposure to external rivalry. From system management to system manipulation. Energy systems are governed by physics, capital stock, and long-term investment cycles. They were not designed for sustained geopolitical interference, yet that is increasingly their operating environment. Under zero-sum rivalry, energy statecraft shifts from managing systems to manipulating them. Petrologic and electrologic do not replace each other. They constrain and reshape each other. The faster logic seeks to interrupt the slower. The slower logic seeks to outlast the faster. The paradox is that the deeper the interdependence, the greater the temptation to weaponize it. And more frequently it is weaponized, the more rigid and costly the system becomes. Energy integration once promised efficiency and stability. Energy rivalry produces resilience at a price. Rivalry not only constrains, it compels adaptation. The systems that endure will be those that convert interference into resilience without abandoning long-term trajectory. The transition is no longer defined by replacement. It is defined by interference. Next up, author Ariel Cohen writes, in Iran, victory is non-negotiable. Dr. Ariel Cohen, Cohen is non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. As the American media remains fixated on the price of gas, inflationary pressures affecting the upcoming midterm elections, and President Trump's ratings in the latest polls, a far more consequential contest is afoot in the Persian Gulf and around the world. While electoral economics dominate the U.S. airwaves and social media, America's escalating conflict with the Islamic Republic of Japan is a historic trial of whether the, quote, free world, including North America, Europe, Israel, Japan, South Korea, and Australia, can defend its vital interests against a determined authoritarian axis. With the demise of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, his de facto successor and security supremo, Ali Larijani, and many other top terror bosses, the U.S. and Israel are addressing the threat that imperiled the West and the Middle East for almost five decades. America's NATO allies issue stern warnings, but do not send naval vessels to escort tankers in the Strait of Hormuz. On the one hand, it is understandable after Trump's threats against Greenland, a territory belonging to Denmark, a NATO ally and an EU member. On the other hand, a huge gap in LNG prices at the Henry Hub in Louisiana and in Europe, 700%, demonstrate that our NATO allies should be more interested in opening the Gulf to tanker traffic than they are. The China-Russia-Iran axis threat. In every generation, the West has faced a defining adversary. In the 20th century, it was the Nazis and the Soviet communists. Today, that opponent is a powerful authoritarian, resource-rich Beijing-Moscow axis and its allies. The combat is kinetic and asymmetric, including cognitive warfare. In the Middle East, a key axis ally is the Shia totalitarian theocratic dictatorship in Tehran. For decades, Iran, Russia, and China agitated for the eviction of the U.S. from the oil-rich Persian Gulf, while providing the weapons, technology training, and diplomatic cover needed to build Iran's Ring of Fire proxy network, including Hamas in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Syria and the Houthis in Yemen. They run terrorist agents and cells in Europe and the U.S., often operating through criminal gangs and drug trafficking networks in the Middle East, Latin America, and Europe. Whether it was the missiles for the Houthis to disrupt global shipping or guns for the brutal killers of Hezbollah and Hamas, Tehran's budget for terror was effectively subsidized by Chinese oil purchases. To win, the West must recognize that whether the chant of death to Israel, death to America is screamed in the Shia holy city of Qom, written on a black or green jihadi banner by a proxy in Gaza, or part of a loyalty oath taken by an operative in the United States or Europe, the target remains the same, the liberal international order. The war with Iran is therefore not a war of choice, but a war of necessity. Neutralizing Tehran's capabilities at minimum, or achieving the long overdue regime change that the tens of thousands of Iranians have sacrificed their lives for, if possible, will disarm the primary pro-Chinese and pro-Russian power in the Middle East, which continues to demand the withdrawal of U.S. military bases while attacking U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain. By bringing Iran to heel alongside the Maduro regime in Venezuela, the United States can effectively regulate the flow of energy fueling China's industrial machine. Establishing American dominance in the Gulf for the coming decades isn't just about oil. It is about ensuring the world's most critical energy and trade arteries are secured by powers that protect the West and the global economy. Notably, this conflict is an opportunity to put the specter of forgiver wars behind us where it belongs. Following the protracted, unsuccessful wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, many feared the West was in terminal retreat. A successful campaign against 47 years of Iranian aggression and nuclear ambitions would prove that the U.S.-led coalition can fight to win. Indeed, political disagreement is a hallmark of our democracy. However, there is a fine line between dissent and empowering our enemies. Those actively rooting for a U.S. defeat are aiding and abetting a murderous, misogynistic theocracy allied with the autocrats in Kremlin and the Chinese Communist Party's Zhang Henhai. Today, Ukraine is the battlefront in Europe. Iran is the battlefront in the Middle East. But the most difficult terrain remains the cognitive war being fought in our own media and halls of learning. The front is characterized by orchestrated, paid-for, coordinated, quote, protests and aggressive social media campaigns where influencers, in quotes also, amplified by foreign bot networks, parrot the talking points the IRGC, the Chinese Communist Party, and the Kremlin, seeking to demoralize the American public and delegitimize the West. This is a war of ideas as much as it is one of missiles. To contain and eventually defeat the China-Russian axis, the West must regain its strategic confidence, defend its integrity, and protect its sanity in Ukraine and in Iran. The price of gas may be high, but the price of failure would be historic. Instead, I think, it is more appropriate to return to the 18th century in its series of world wars, culminating in the Seven Years' War, 1756 to 1763, that the emerging world war, lowercase, we see today is more akin to that global struggle than trying to shoehorn contemporary developments into a World War II straitjacket. For many Americans, any mention of the Seven Years' War draws a blank. However, its North American theater, the French and Indian War, might elicit a glimmer of recognition since it involved George Washington. Yet the American tendency to refer to the world wars of the 18th century by localized names blinds us to the reality that wars fought in North America were also part of a larger global struggle between two principal opponents, Great Britain and France. In that light, our own Revolutionary War was also a continuation of that global struggle. Moreover, these wars were fought on a global scale, not confined to Europe, but with battles taking place all around the world. Yet, while there were two core rivalries in play, France versus Great Britain and Austria versus Prussia, with the Franco-Austrian alliance poised against the Anglo-Prussian collaboration, the war as a whole was defined by fragile and shifting coalitions and uneasy ententes among the core participants and their associates. At various points, other states, such as Spain, Portugal, and Russia, as well as polities in West Africa, the Indian subcontinent, and the Far East, took part in the war, but in more limited or variable ways. Most notably, Russia even switched sides in 1762, initially fighting against Prussia, but ultimately concluding a peace with Frederick the Great and providing him with Russian forces in his continuing struggles with Austria. Every combatant in the Seven Years' War had reasonably clear objectives and a sense of their national interests. There was no sense that these were two alliances defined by a sense of solidarity and that an attack on one anywhere was an assault against all. The Native American Wabanaki Confederacy joined the French to fight the British and the British colonists in North America, but this did not make them allies of Austria, nor did they view the Austrian-Russian defeat of the Prussians at the Battle of Kunersdorf as in any way related to their own efforts. The Wabanaki were simply caught up in a localized conflict generated, but not necessarily tied to, the main war in Europe. The fact that the Spanish held off the British in the Philippines did not impact the British ability to defeat the Nawab of Bengal, and Prussia was completely uninvolved in any aspect of the World War outside of Central Europe, even as serious defeats were experienced by its partners in North and South America and South and East Asia. Significantly, the Seven Years' War did not end as a result of a single overarching peace conference, but a series of often bilateral arrangements that ended specific conflicts and created regional settlements unconnected from any global framework. Significantly, putative allies who had achieved victory in one theater did not seek to translate that into favorable conditions for their partners elsewhere in the world. There was no single VE or VJ day, and the final balance sheet of the Seven Years' War was that, other than Great Britain, every major combatant had mixed results from their participation. If the 21st century is going to look more like the 18th in terms of our understanding of world war, that's lowercase w's in both words, it is time for us to revive and put back into general usage the term entente and retire the term axis. What we have right now is a series of entente relationships, agreements among states for some degree of cooperation and coordination, but falling well short of a consolidated alliance. This can facilitate what Teresa Fallon has called strategic intimacy, but does not presuppose a consolidated, integrated structure and commonality of purpose. Great Britain learned during the Seven Years' War how to use flexible arrangements to manage global power dynamics, and particularly how to cope with the threat of simultaneity in multiple theaters of operations. These lessons served the British in good stead for another two centuries, and are the ones that the United States ought to consider as we move into a more multipolar and unstable global environment. And that is a wrap-up for The National Interest for this week's broadcast. I do hope that you have enjoyed listening to these articles as much as I have had in reading them for you. I'll give you a couple of teaser titles, which I usually do for next week's broadcast. The first is Benjamin Zeiker's The Upsides and Downsides of Senator Cotton's Data Act, D-A-T-A. Next, Justin Mitchell writes Why Russia and China Aren't Helping Iran. Joseph Hammond writes how Europe is racing to secure lithium supply with new mining efforts. Nicholas Jagdazi writes how Georgia supports Iran's war effort. A new constitution for a just, strong, and prosperous Kazakhstan. Why America's AI push in Armenia faces political and security risks. Next, artificial intelligence needs nuclear power and allied cooperation. Does the U.S. have a day-after plan in Iran? And Afghanistan was always Pakistan's problem. Now it's Pakistan's crisis. So these and others we'll be bringing to you in the coming weeks in American Interest. Again, thank you very much for listening. Have a wonderful day.